this first lesson, I'll be honest, is pretty tough because it's like, where do you, if you got to eat an elephant, where do you start? You just got to get going, you know. When you're going to talk about the Bible, I kind of want to give you a little bit of an introduction, but we will actually talk about one specific thing tonight. What I want to introduce you to, turn to 2 Timothy 4. With tonight's lesson, more than the others, we will be turning to quite a few passages. And I don't plan to do sword drills every night, but this first one will be particularly appropriate for it. 2 Timothy 4. Can somebody read verses 1 and 2? All right, so Paul commands Timothy to preach, and he tells him to preach what? Well, that's when and how, but what is he supposed to preach? He's supposed to preach the word. Well, that assumes Timothy knew what the word was. And when we talk about bibliology, that is kind of what we're getting at, is, well, whose word? What is the word? Where is the word found? We have all these questions that when we read a verse like that, we're trained in such a way that we just assume we know what we're talking about. But someone who picks up the Bible for the first time and says, well, preach the word. Well, what's the word? And why do you think this is the word? Why not the word that Catholics have? Why not the word that the Jehovah's Witness have? Why not? Why this word? And why these words in particular? So we're trying to think through the issue of Scripture because it does impact everything else in one sense. So bibliology, if you didn't know, that's what we're calling this. Bibliology, the study of the Bible, or a word about the Bible, if you will. It's our attempt to bring clarity to these kind of questions. So let me just read you this definition that I found on bibliology, and this will help set the trajectory of where we're going. Bibliology is a theme of systematic theology that deals with issues related to the nature and character of the Bible, the purpose of which is to understand what kind of book the Bible is, discover its veracity, how it's authoritative for Christians, to know to what extent it's divine revelation, and what are its limits of revelation. So we're just doing a Bible study on the Bible. And I know that this sounds a little circular, and that's what people will say. Our response to that every time is there's no ultimate authority argument you can use that's not circular. Okay? So why would some people say the Bible shouldn't be used to defend the Bible? What should you use? Just whatever. I don't care what your answer is. What should you use to authorize the Bible if it's not the Bible? So people would use history. So my question is, why is history authoritative? So why are written down things authoritative? It's like, because they are. That's what their answer is. Everyone ultimately gets backed up into an answer of, because it is, just stop asking me. You know, that's what everyone eventually gets to. If you say, well, I believe in creation. Well, no, science says, well, why is science the authority? Because science is the authority. And so everyone ultimately, your ultimate standard has to be circular in one sense. Because if you had another standard, it wouldn't be your ultimate standard. Does that make sense? So if we said that we know the Bible's true because we found Noah's Ark, well, Noah's Ark has the authority to tell you this is true, and therefore Noah's Ark stands above the Bible. Does that make sense? So this is where when we hear someone say, well, that argument's circular, I'm fine embracing that. Yeah, it is, because God's word is ultimately authoritative. And in a Romans 9 sense, who are you, O man, to answer back to God? That kind of a thing. So bibliology is a starting point that we need to have because it serves as a foundation for every other theological pursuit that we have. If I asked you, how are people saved? What would you say? Faith in Christ. Where on earth did you get that from? Then why would you trust the Bible? See, those kind of questions, like, how long did it take God to create everything? 6 days. Where did you get that mess? You see what I'm saying? It's like, oh, from the Bible. So we're rooting all of our beliefs in what this book says. So we better know why we do that with this book and not any other book in history. We're wanting to know and understand what God has said, and so we need his words. We need to understand them. Again, if we go wrong on this doctrine, you will be wrong on every other doctrine. And when you see someone fall into heresy, when you see someone going off the rails with their theology, It comes back to this, that they weren't treating this like they should have. Again, we only have 10 weeks to do this, and so we will be zooming through some of the issues that could get whole topics on their own, whole series on their own. And I know everyone's here to study bibliology, but I do want to start off with another issue. And this is the first thing that I want to open up with this idea of bibliology, and it's this. It's the doctrine of revelation. Now, when you think revelation, you may think the last book of the Bible, right? And that's fine. There's a reason that that's good. But when I talk about just revelation in general, what I mean is this, and here's a definition I want to read to you. The word revelation, or the Greek word apokalupto or apokalypsis, it means an uncovering or a disclosure of something previously hidden. When used with respect to God, revelation means the disclosing of God's existence and perfections to man. What we're getting at is when we talk about God, we can only do that because he's revealed himself. So to take this a little further, the basic idea of revelation is to unveil or uncover or bring to light or disclose something and make it known to that which was previously unknown and unknowable. Divine revelation is God's disclosure of himself through a means to humanity. And that's what this whole class is about, is trying to understand how God has disclosed himself, how he's revealed himself. What God reveals in revelation is otherwise not just unknown, but unknowable. So if you turn to 1 Timothy 6, it's not like knowing God's really hard and he helped us out by giving us the Bible. It's knowing God is impossible, so he reveals himself, and more than just in the Bible, which has to be qualified, and it will as we go through. Again, to be known by creation, God must make himself known. He has to choose to make himself known, or no one would ever know him. Again, this means that we're in need of revelation because we're creatures, not just because we're sinners. 1 Timothy 6:16. Help fill in the blank. Talking about God, Lord of Lords, verse 15. Who alone has immortality, who dwells in what? What was it? What kind of light? Unapproachable light, which I don't know how much you studied that word unapproachable, but we at least know it means that it can't be approached. Like you can't get to it. So when we think about revelation, don't think about man trying to figure out and discover who God is. Think God revealing and disclosing himself to humanity. Revelation is God revealing himself to us, not us discovering our way to God. And that's part of what we have to start with. Our knowledge of God depends 100% on his self-disclosure. Look at 1 Timothy 6:16 again. It's not just unapproachable light, but notice the next description. Whom no one has ever what? And now if we stop there, all that said is no one's ever seen God. But notice how it keeps going. Or what? Can see. So it's not just no one's ever seen God. He's unseeable. So if you're going to know anything about a God who's unapproachable and unseeable, he's got to reveal himself. And so that's why we start off with revelation, because God reveals himself as a gift, or God reveals himself in a way that we're dependent on that. We need him to do that because we can never approach him or find him or see him on our own. This is going to be, and we'll get into this later with issues of clarity and stuff, but this is why often in Scripture you see God use what we call accommodation language. So you're used to this when it says, like, God has a wing, right? Now, you don't picture God having a wing. You know that's God's way of talking to us in a way that we can understand what can't be understood otherwise. The same thing is true when it talks about God leaving a place. Where is God? Everywhere, right? So when it says he left somewhere, it's got to be saying something that otherwise couldn't be known, and he says it that way because we're limited in our understanding. This is why Calvin, one of my favorite quotes from him, Calvin in his institutes, he says that the Bible, even though it's inexhaustible, will never scrape the surface well enough, much less get to the bottom. He says this is God's baby talk. When you kneel down to talk to babies, what do? You lower your language, you raise your voice to a higher, you're kinder, you're more gentle. You don't bring the full weight of your vocabulary and all that. The Bible, being God's revelation to us is done in a way that he accommodates our inability to comprehend him in one sense. So I'm saying all this because God dwells in unapproachable light. He is unable to be seen, and yet he still reveals himself. He makes himself known. And again, to hit on this before we miss it, again, this was necessary even before the fall. So for instance, how did Adam know which tree to not eat from? God told him. He revealed it. Do you see what I'm saying? It wasn't that Adam was created and he knew exactly what he should do. God revealed himself to Adam. Adam would not have known to not eat that tree if God didn't reveal it to him. And so this is a creature need that we have, not just a sinner need. Without divine revelation, we would be left with our speculation only, which is what you see every day. When people close their Bibles, they ignore God's word. Whatever they say about God is just their best guess. Or they take their grandma's word for it, or just whatever else they do. We can't be left to our best guesses. We need what God says about God. Revelation is a divine activity. And God's revelation comes to us. Again, we don't go to it. It's not something discovered by us. It's something given to us by God. Our knowledge of God is revealed to us by him through something. And those are the things we'll talk about tonight. The revealer is God. The object of the revelation is God. And it's given to man. And so since God is a God who reveals himself, we want to talk about the means that he uses. And so all we'll do tonight is talk about what's commonly called general revelation. General revelation. Turn to Psalm 19. As I was thinking about how to go through this, I thought the best way to do it would be look at some passages that originally I was wanting to do revelation, general, and special all tonight. I think you'll be more served if we can walk through the passages in a survey way, but walk through several passages that teach you what God says about general revelation and why we call it that, where we get our assumptions from this, and you'll see the passages. I'll give you everything that I can on this issue. And so we're going to be turning a lot, but it's going to be for your benefit. Look at Psalm 19, verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. Their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the earth. In them he has set a tent for the sun, which comes out like a bridegroom leaving his chamber, and like a strong man runs its course with joy. Its rising is from the end of the heavens, and its circuit to the end of them. And there is nothing hidden from its heat. What we learn here is verse 1. Verse 1, somebody tell me, what is David talking about here? What is doing the declaring and the proclaiming? What's doing that in verse 1? Okay, the heavens, right? So in one sense, we can say creation. Don't just think the sky and that's it, although that's the focus here. When we talk about general revelation, we're thinking just generically with creation. Creation is, according to verse 1, doing two things. It's declaring and it's proclaiming. But if you'll notice, you don't hear stars talk. This is a nonverbal revelation, if you will. It's a general revelation through creation. So the heavens, verse 1, they do two things. They declare and they proclaim. Now, what do they declare? The glory of God. And what do they proclaim? His handiwork. So there's something about God. When we think about God's glory, we're thinking about him manifesting himself, him displaying his attributes or perfections. There's something that creation does to display something about God, and we'll get more into that, but it's here called his glory, and the skies proclaim his handiwork. So you can look at creation and know something about God's glory. Again, we'll see more in a second. And you can also know that he works with his hands, although God doesn't have hands. Again, there's accommodation language. He's displaying his might and his majesty. And notice, if the heavens are what's doing this, that covers creation. And so this is, in one sense, why we call it general revelation. It's everywhere. You don't have to go anywhere to find this, right? We don't have to use Wycliffe to send out general revelation. We use Wycliffe to send out special, right? People are created aware of what's revealed in general revelation. We'll see more on this later. But notice the universal theater and how that shows this is revelation for everybody. And we'll see that again in verse 4. But look at verse 1 again. The source is the heavens. What do? They declare and they proclaim. Verse 2, when do they do this? Somebody tell me that from verse 2. Day to day. And what do you think that means? They just take the nights off. What does day to day mean? All the time. It doesn't stop. There's not a time where creation's not preaching or it's not declaring and proclaiming without words, mind you, but that's the language used here of a preacher, if you will. It pours out speech, and night to night it reveals knowledge. This is constantly going on. So we call it general because it's generally happening all the time to all people through all creation. Even verse 3, look at this. There is no speech, nor are there words, whose voice is not heard. Again, it doesn't depend on you listening to their words. General revelation is rooted in what we're seeing here, creation. And here's the thing, another reason we call it general is because it doesn't depend on your capabilities. What God reveals through general revelation is not learned in one sense. We're not taking someone who's neutral and pointing them to creation, hoping they'll come away with the right conclusions. We'll get to Romans 1 in a minute, but Romans 1 lets us know that they already know the right conclusions and they reject them. And that's what is going on here, that this wordless speech, if you will, these preachers who don't talk in one sense, they're constantly revealing God's glory, his handiwork, and it doesn't depend on your learning them. This kind of bypasses Babel's curse, if you will. Verse 4, their voice goes out, notice, through all the earth. Here's your general language. And their words to the end of the world. So let me ask you this. Does everybody in the world have a Bible? No, they don't, right? This is obvious. Does everyone in the world have a form of revelation? Yes. And so if I said, now why would you say something that crazy? What about the person born in some tribe in Africa? His parents have him, drop him off as a baby. Somehow he's raised by monkeys and he survives. And he doesn't know another human being. How can you tell me that he has revelation? What would you say? Yeah, Psalm 19. This is apologetics. It's Psalm 19 says it. He is a witness of creation. God promises he has it. So the extent is through all the earth. And we'll just finish with Psalm 19 here. Notice the way it's regulated. It's consistent, if you will. It says, in them he has set a tent for the sun, which comes out like a bridegroom leaving his chamber, and like a strong man runs its course with joy. Its rising is from the end of the heavens and its circuit to the end of them, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. Again, it seems to be talking about predictability and orderliness. All of this preaches something about God, and it can be known in a general way to general humanity. We're going to come back to this in a little bit because Romans 10 is going to quote Psalm 19. So just remember, Psalm 19 is letting you know that general revelation goes out through creation to everyone. Now look at Ecclesiastes 3:11. Ecclesiastes 3:11. Right after, go through the rest of the Psalms and Proverbs. And Ecclesiastes 3:11. Notice, and again, fill the blank in for me if you can. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has what? He has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. Here's a passage that I want to read just in passing because I know it gets poorly recorded when, you know, you got a God-shaped hole in your heart and there's just so much bad baggage that comes with that phrase. But I understand what people mean, according to Ecclesiastes 3:11. God has put eternity in man's heart. Part of this is probably what we may call residue from being created in God's image. We'll use this language again later. But when God created man in his image, there's a certain revealing of God's glory that man's supposed to be doing that people are aware of, that will pop out from time to time. So you take the most vigilant, atheistic, homosexual, whatever you want to call them, you take the most fierce advocate for that, and when, let's try to make this a little more helpful. Let's say that I am the number one advocate. I'm an atheist, and I'm the number one advocate for being able to have abortions. Okay, let's just go this route. And so sometimes I'll use the argument that what if this lady gets pregnant and can't afford to raise her child? You're going to force her to have that baby? My basic argument is you better let her have an abortion or it's not what? Starts with an F, ends with an R. Yeah, there you go. It's not fair. Well, I just revealed that I've got some knowledge of a sense of justice, right? Now, I'm totally botching this thing. Like, I'm advocating that abortion's fair and just, and it's not at all. I'm just saying, I just popped out. You'll understand my phrase in a little bit. Imagine holding a beach ball underwater. Every now and then, that beach ball will pop out, and you go, hey, there's leftover image of God that you're messing up, but it's there. And this seems to be part of it, is when we see people living in a way that shows they know this life isn't all there is. No matter what they may say on the surface, it pops out every now and then. You know this life isn't it. You can come back to Ecclesiastes 3:11 and see that God has put eternity in every man's heart. God has done this. And even James 3:9 lets us know that even in lost, sinful, fallen humans, they still have the image of God. As broken and messed up as it may be, it's still there. And it sneaks out every now and then. Look at Acts 14. Acts 14. We're going to get to some more clear passages in the New Testament now dealing with what God reveals in general revelation, as we call it. So just to set some context for you, Paul has just healed a lame man. And so if you remember, they responded to him by thinking he was a god. And so he says in verse 15, men, why are you doing these things? We also are men of like nature with you, and we bring you good news that you should turn from these vain things to a living God who has made the heaven, and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. Verse 16, in past generations, he allowed all nations to walk in their own ways, yet he did not leave himself without witness. Notice the language. God bore witness of himself. Because he did good by giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your heart with food and gladness. Notice again, Paul is appealing to this idea that it's obvious through God's general benevolence to humanity that God's good. He's done good to you. It's rare to find a culture that doesn't want to have their God do good to them. As pagan as they may force that to be, the idea still is there. Their concept of God naturally includes he's good. And we see that here. He provides. God has wise providence, if you will. Verse 17, he did not leave himself without witness because he did good by giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. Paul's making it clear that the part of general revelation here is God's goodness to people. I mean, in one sense, I've said it before, but even Hitler got breath, right? I mean, I'm sure there were foods that Hitler enjoyed. As wicked as he was, he still got that. Jesus says that God makes it rain on the who and who, the just and the unjust. Everybody partakes in God's general goodness. Look at Acts 17. This is going to be a little more familiar to you. Although this still isn't the most clear passage on it. We're saving that one. Acts 17, verse 16. We're going to read a longer portion, although there's just a small part I want to look at. Now, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, his spirit was provoked within him, and as he saw a city that was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and devout persons and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. And some said, what does this babbler wish to say? Others said, he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities, because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what the new teaching is that you are presenting. Verse 20, for you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean. Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. Verse 22. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. What therefore you worship as an unknown, this I proclaim to you. The God who has made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since, and here's a part of what's generally known, he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. So Paul is leaning on the fact that even these pagans would know that God is the source of life and breath and everything. Look at verse 26. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth. Just as a side note, that is what's rooted where my comments earlier are coming from. If you buy into the racist schemes of here are blacks, here are whites, here are yellow, I don't know all the color spectrums, you deny our union not just in Adam but even in Noah, that we all came from this one family, and you throw a lot of wrenches into it for who Christ is. And we'll get into that, but that's where I'm getting it from. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined in allotted periods and boundaries of dwelling place that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us. Notice verse 28, for in him we live and move and have our being. Another thing that's generally known. We're creatures of God. It's rare to find an individual who's so warped in their thinking that they deny this obvious fact that we are creatures and there's a God. As even some of your own poets have said, for we indeed are his offspring. Again, Paul referring to what was commonly known even to their poets. This is the passage I really want to get to, though. Romans 1. This is where we'll start to see what we mean by general revelation. We've so far just been talking about general things that are generally known to everybody through creation. This is where it gets a little more specific as far as we can make some dogmatic statements about general revelation. This is the best passage for you to think through on general revelation. Romans 1, verse 16. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God and salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. Notice verse 18 starts off with a for, or because. Because the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up in the lust of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. For their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature, and the men likewise gave up natural relations with women who were were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. So this passage makes a couple things clear that I want to walk through this, because if you can get this, you'll understand why we say some of the things we do in evangelism and apologetics and things like that. Look back at verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed, so we're talking about revelation, is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. Who is he about to describe here? Help me out here. Do a little Bible study. He says, men who, and so he's further explaining these men, okay, who by their unrighteousness, what do they do? Okay, does that sound like ignorant people who just need help? What does it sound like? Yeah, willful rebellion. So the example I used earlier, I got it from Dr. Vlock in seminary. He said that the unbeliever, no matter what they say out of their mouth, they're like the person who takes a beach ball and shoves it underwater and says, what beach ball? The one you're shoving underwater. I don't see a beach ball. Oh, it's because you're willfully pushing it underwater. And every now and then, they'll get distracted and poof, it'll pop out and they'll grab it again and they'll put it back down. What I mean by that is when they say, well, I don't believe in your God because how could a, what kind of God? Good God do what? Yeah, boop, it just popped out. It's like, what do you mean good? Where's good come from if there's no God? It just popped, your you know, presuppositional understanding that God exists is showing, that kind of thing. So notice it says, by their unrighteousness, they suppress the truth. This means that truth has been given, it's been known, and it's been suppressed. They don't want it. Verse 19, because, and here he's explaining the suppression of truth, because what can be known about God is what to them? Is confusing and hard, and they need help. And no, it is what to them? It is plain. It is obvious to them. For what can be known about God is plain to them. Why? Because God has shown it to them. Remember, this is our idea of revelation. God gave it to them. He generally gave this knowledge to all people. Because God has shown it to them. Again, not only is God still showing people, but here the specific reference is he has shown it and they rejected what's obvious. Verse 20. Again, because his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature. So those are the things that are generally known. There's two more. Eternal power. People can know generically that God is powerful. They can also know that he is divine there, that there is a God. He's God, he's not man, those kind of ideas. Again, it gets hard to draw the specific lines. But they've been clearly perceived. Notice, again, there's no one that's rejecting God because they're confused. Do you understand this? When someone says, I'm an atheist, it's not because God's revelation was unclear. It's because they didn't like what they naturally knew. And that's what he says in verse 20. His invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly, notice again, the word's not clearly revealed, it's clearly what? Do what? Perceived. Now, who does perceiving? Does the person giving revelation do the perceiving? Or does the person receiving revelation do the perceiving? The one receiving it. So Paul's saying men have perceived it clearly. And what'd they do with it? They rejected it and suppressed it. And notice, this has been going on generally throughout history, ever since the creation of the world. And the things that have been made. So again, this is where we get our idea that general revelation is through creation. God made the world, and through that, he reveals himself. So, they are what? Without excuse. This is why we say that no one comes to judgment day and says, well, I just didn't have enough information. This is why we don't believe in the person who's in the lost tribe somewhere who never hears, and so they're innocent. I've used the joke before, but someone says, well, what about that innocent person and boingo, boingo, or whatever it is? What if they never hear? And the problem with the question is what? You know this. Yeah, you just assume someone was innocent. Are they a human? Well, yeah, they're a human. Then they're a sinner. Do you understand the logic here? Paul's saying no matter where someone is, no matter who they are, they have clearly perceived the things that God has revealed. And so they are responsible, and yet because they rejected it, they're guilty. And let me just suggest to you, if you don't have that theology, you lose a strong impetus for evangelism and missions. If people are only guilty when they hear and reject, then the best thing we could do is shut our mouths and just stay together one-on-one. Why would you ever go witness to anybody? Am I right? Why would you ever take the chance that they'll reject you? Just let them die ignorant and they'll go to heaven. But again, we know that's not true because what they have already been revealed, they rejected. So verse 21, again, explaining more because or for, although they, what? Knew God. Now, we know there's a sense to where knowing God is like in a saving way, okay? Now, clearly, we're not talking about, although they weren't saved, they're not saved anymore. That's not the point, right? What form of knowing God do you think he's talking about here? Yeah, a general knowledge that God's there, he's powerful, he's real, those kind of things, right? So there is a real knowledge of God. It's not a saving knowledge. We're not there yet, but it's a real knowledge. But what they do with that knowledge, or I guess the better question is, what didn't they do? They did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became what? Fools, and they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. This is why everywhere that the biblical gods rejected, you have some form of idolatry. It could be idolatry in Roman Catholicism. It could be idolatry in Mormonism. It could be idolatry in Islam. It could be idolatry even in atheism, where now you're the god. But you're going to reject God and take on some other form of a god to worship. And this is because we were created to be worshipers. And so you will worship. Everyone on earth worships. It's just what or who do you worship? And here we're learning that if they turn from the biblical God, they're turning to something else to worship something else. And notice verse 24. Therefore, God did what? Gave them up. And I'm just telling you, I'm 33 and I don't mind saying it. Our world is the given up world right now. I mean, if ever you read a passage and you look up and you go, yep, seems about right. It's Romans 1. One of my favorite sermons from Pastor MacArthur is his sermon, When God Abandons a Nation. And it's just so helpful to look at when you have a society that does this and then chaos breaks out. It's not rocket science. If you turn the lights off and you start tripping over everything, I can tell you why. If you turn these lights on, you'll be able to see a lot better. And so Romans 1 is letting us know more and more about general revelation. There's two more passages I want to look at. Romans 2. It's right next to Romans 1. Pretty easy to find. Romans 2, verse 11. For God shows no partiality. For who all have what? But what about that innocent guy in Africa? It's like, look, you just have a reading problem. For all have sinned without the, I'm sorry, all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law, and all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. Because, or for, it is not the hearers of the law who are righteous before God, but the doers of the law who will be justified. And here's where it gets into our territory, general revelation. For when Gentiles, now let me ask you, who are Gentiles? Yes, us, but who are Gentiles? Non-Jews, okay? You got God's people, you got not God's people. You got Jews, you got Gentiles, okay? That's how the Old Testament's set up. So these are people outside of Israel. For when Gentiles who do not have what? The law. What's the law? Okay, so there's a summary of the Ten Commandments. What covenant are we probably talking about here? Mosaic covenant. Okay, these nations don't have that. That is special revelation, and they don't have it. For when Gentiles who do not have the law by what? By instinct. What ESV says, nature, what's NASB say? Instinctively. This is getting back to our Ecclesiastes 3. God's put eternity in their hearts. This is getting back to our Genesis 1:26. God made man in his image. This is getting back to that. Notice, for when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do what the law requires, they are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. Again, this is why glimpses of God's image show up. This is why that atheistic homosexual at the rally who argues for fairness is a contradiction. But the contradiction makes sense because you're making God's image and you're twisting it like crazy. I get why you care about justice. I really do get it. You just have no clue how to get it. You have no clue how to go about attaining it. When they say it's not fair for you to do X, Y, and Z, they have no defense of what fair even means. But they know it's something that should exist because they're creating God's image. And that's a part of it that they're not suppressing. They're just twisting it, if you will. Does that argument make sense to you? Is everybody following me here? When you meet an atheist who says, I can't believe in a God that would be so evil, you just introduced a concept that only makes sense with the Bible. Evil. If there is no God, there is no evil. I mean, I'm not joking here, but with COVID, who was the highest risk category with COVID-19? Mary said me. Okay, so we'll be careful how we describe them, but who are they? Okay, the more seasoned saints, right? The more, okay. So our XYZers is what I've heard before. So older people. Now, this is me taking the logic of evolution to its logical end. This is not Josh's thoughts here. But if I'm an atheist and I believe in evolution, I'm rejoicing. Like, they're weak. Get rid of them. And yet you see a world caring about them. Like, I can explain that, but you can't. Why do you care? They called people who wanted to go to church grandma killers. I don't know if you caught that or not, but they would say, well, you want to assemble, all you want to do is kill old people. Well, what do you care? If they die, they're weak, right? Let's get rid of them. Oh, you care about them because they're humans. I know why, because they're creating God's image, and you are too, and that's why you naturally know you ought to have some sort of care for them, but you don't know how to explain it. You don't know how to do it. We've got answers right here. Does that make sense? Am I explaining this correctly? Me and Seth talk about some of these things. Again, the idea here is they by nature do what the law requires, even if they're doing it while bowing to Buddha or whatever, however anything works. They naturally show these common threads that they just twist and pervert. And so this is the idea. Look at Romans 10. This will be the last one we look at. We'll be done, take some questions. I do miss teaching a class like this because I don't have to stick to sermon notes and I can turn my mute button on and say stuff and turn it back off. And Romans 10, look at verse 14. Now, this is all about special revelation right here, okay? Verse 14, how then will they call on him in whom they've not believed? So that's letting you know that, let's back up, I'm sorry. Verse 12, there's no distinction between Jew and Greek, for the same Lord is Lord of all, bestowing his riches on all who call on him. So if you want to be blessed by the Lord, what do you have to do? Verse 12, call upon him. Verse 13, why does that work? Because everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. So who will be saved? Yes, we can say both everyone who calls on the name of the Lord and only those who call on the name of the Lord. See how this works? Look at verse 14. How then will they call on him who they've not what? Believed. And so if you're going to be saved, you got to call. If you're going to call, you got to believe. And how are they to believe in the one that they've not what? Heard. And how are they to hear without someone doing what? Preaching. And how are they to preach unless they're sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. This is a clear evidence that people need special revelation to be saved. General revelation isn't going to cut it for two reasons. It's general. It doesn't tell you how to be saved. And secondly, because the only thing you've done with general revelation so far is reject it. But verse 16, but they have not all obeyed the gospel, for Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed what he has heard from us? So faith comes by hearing, and hearing through the word of Christ. But I ask, have they not heard? Indeed they have. Why? Because Psalm 19, their voice has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. The idea in general revelation is this. God has generally revealed God has generally revealed authoritative and clear things to people that leaves them responsible, and yet because they reject it, they're left condemned. No one is saved through general revelation. We don't say, look, they got pine trees, that's good enough. We don't do that. You don't look at a tree and go, kind of looks like a cross. I bet somebody could die on a cross for my sins. That's just not how it works. That's not what God's revealing through general revelation. And so you have in Romans 10, it seems to be the idea that they have heard. They're not with excuse, if you will. They are without excuse. But they haven't heard the special revelation of what they need to be forgiven for the fact that they've rejected God all the way up to this point in their life. So just to end this, I want to draw some conclusions. to general revelation. When we talk about general revelation, God does reveal himself in a general way to who? To whom? Who does God reveal himself to in this general way? All people, okay? So generally to all men at all times, where? All in all places, right? And how do you know that? Because Psalm 19 says, what's doing the preaching? The heavens, the creation is. And Romans 1 and Romans 2 lets us know that it's not just external preachers. Where else is another form of revelation found? Yeah, internally, right? You've got a conscience. You're creating God's image. You know internally that God's there, and you know externally he's there. Again, we say general just to highlight the idea that it's a general audience with general content. This revelation comes, this revelation of God comes through creation, and it's through the conscience. It has been around, as Romans 1 says, since the beginning of creation. It's not just been around, but it's been understood clearly and rejected. Man's natural response to this revelation is to do what with it? To reject it. Is it to reject it because he's confused? No, it's rejected because he understands it and doesn't like it. It's like John 3 says, the light has come into the world, but they rejected the world because they loved what? Darkness rather than the light. Now, no offense to roaches, but if we could compare sinners to roaches, it's like when you turn a light on. What does a roach do? It shoots off, right? Now, again, I'm not meaning to demean roaches and compare them to sinners. But the idea is the same. You turn that light on, and people squeal. It's like, don't read that book. I've never seen people so afraid of paper in one sense, but it's not the fact that it's ink on a page. It's what is being revealed in it that they hate. Again, there's much about God that's not revealed in general revelation, and so that's why next week what we'll do is take our time to think about special revelation. And here's one of the concepts I want to get into your head next week, just start chewing on it now, is special revelation for us in our day is the Bible, but as a category, it's more than the Bible. Okay? I don't want you to think your uncle's vision that he got in a dream when he had a bad dinner or something is special revelation. That's not my point. But God has revealed himself in ways, special, specific ways, that we now have a lot of it codified in the Bible, and this is our form of special revelation, but I want to talk about all the ways that God was doing it throughout history that we have recorded in here. So next week, I want to talk about God's special or specific revelation. Any questions on what we've talked about tonight or anything that needs to be clarified or helped out?